Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 140, recorded on October 20th, 2021. The Cloud Pod buys all its Synapse in advance. Good evening, Peter. How's it going?
Hey, going well. How are you?
Good, good. We have a couple of guest hosts. Jonathan and Ryan are off on some business meetings and not available this evening. And so we tapped out to some people who we know in the community. First up is Rob Martin. Rob is very active in our Slack community and been a good friend of the show for quite a while. I don't even know when you first started listening, but it's been a while.
The first episode.
Oh, wow. And
there you go. First episode. So, you know, he is part of the FinOps Foundation. I'll let you introduce yourself, Rob.
Hey, thanks for having me here. Yeah, I'm the director of learning for the FinOps Foundation. So anybody who's taken the FinOps certification course has seen me in my bookshelves for hours at a time.
Those are good bookshelves. They have quite a quantity of books that no one can see because we don't record this video, but we can see it here as your former guest host here. And then Ben Garrison, who is with Jump Cloud, who is currently a sponsor, but has also been active in our Slack community. And Ben is with them doing all things DevRel. So maybe you want to introduce yourself, Ben?
Yes. Again, thanks for having me here. Ben Garrison with Jump Cloud. I have the coolest yet most suspect title at the company. My official title is technical evangelist. I call it technical champion, though. So been at Jump Cloud now since March of 2020. I don't have any cool books that you can see behind me, but I do have a plant. His name is Fred. He's a fiddly fig. So
he's a lovely looking fig. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you for joining. I'm sure you'll both be better than Ryan and Jonathan because it doesn't take a lot to do that. But yeah, we'll take you through the show. It's fun. It's good. Just dialogue. And we'll talk about some things that happened this week in cloud and you can tell us what you think about it. And it's just no big deal. You can't get it wrong. It's just your opinion. So it's a wonderful thing.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, we have some general news this week because there's been a couple of conferences that have been going on. So we're going to talk about some cloud adjacent technology. First up is Splunk. They had their annual .conf21 conference, which I think is just .conf, and then they add the year every year. But I didn't do the research before the show to actually confirm that. And they released a ton of updates for Splunk. And if you're into Splunk, then you should have to go check those out. We don't cover all of those announcements. But the big one is that we have talked many, many times about the horrendous price of Splunk in general, and the overall tax it's put on your logging and your logging infrastructure for years. And so, it always had the negative effect that you maybe didn't want to log things because that, of course, jack up your bill with Splunk, which is the exact opposite thing you want to do in observability where you're monitoring everything that moves. And, after getting mercilessly dragged here by the CloudPod hosts, I became aware that they are starting to offer additional pricing for small customers around workload-based pricing. And at .conf21, they announced that this new workload pricing enables, or is now giving you workload-based pricing, which enables value-oriented pricing. So now you pay by the workload versus paid by the volume, which now makes it much more easy to predict your costs and makes it much more capable for your use case. They also announced a new Flex Index option for customers that choose workload-based pricing to enable longer-term retention for lower-value data, as well as are now going to be announcing the Smart Store, first with Azure, but then with AWS and GCP as well. So you put your really old, large data into object storage natively, which is pretty great. And if you are an Azure, a Splunk customer, you definitely should look at the price options and see if this is a cost savings for you, because I'm going to guess it probably is.
Yeah, this is really interesting to see. I have used Splunk as the cornerstone of logging and observability in older jobs. But, there the biggest value you get out of Splunk is hiring the best Splunk engineer you can possibly get, because they can do, when you've got somebody who's really tuned into it, you can do magical things. But it was always a trade-off of, do we keep this stuff or do we add more stuff and keep the volumes down and stuff going in? I think this is really smart and it's really nice to see them trying to address this. I think this is, on-premises vendors like this are going to have to move as they move towards the cloud. They're going to have to make these kinds of adjustments to, I think, keep their market share up.
Any definition of what a workload is? I didn't see it in the article, but this seems to be one of those things that could help some people and hurt others.
I mean, typically it's based on some family of apps, right? So, if you have a product cookies for pets or something like that, that cookies for pet workload would basically be what you would declare, and you basically declare what those edges of that workload are, and that everything gets logged from those devices would then be included in that workload price. But it is a bit subjective. So you could be in danger if you don't do it properly. But from what I've seen, the pricing is significantly cheaper and much more in line with other cloud providers who are offering you a logging in the cloud or even rolling your own Elasticsearch cluster as well.
Yeah, it makes you want to go read up on the new Flex Index that they talk about in that preview to see if there's how much of a data savings for, you know, your ingest and your searching and that kind of stuff is concerned. When that Flex Index would be interesting to dive into a little bit more.
All right. Well, moving from Splunk to HashiCorp, another fantastic product that we talk about all the time here, Terraform and all things Packer and all that. We talked about them rewriting a Packer a few months back into the Golang from their native, I don't even know what it's built in at this point, but they basically announced a transition that they were going to actually start supporting HCL, so you didn't have to know a different Packer language runtime. And they're now making that available to you in beta, announced at the HashiConf, of course. This allows you to now write all your Packer configuration in HCL. But even more interesting is the new HCP provider, which is what they're calling the HashiCorp Packer now, for Terraform will now let you declare an HCP Packer channel, or basically an image, and ensure that every provisioning pipeline always uses the appropriate image. And if the Packer channel gets updated, because maybe a new patch got deployed, it can then trigger a new Terraform run every time the image is updated using Terraform Cloud, which is a really great connective tissue to really make, you know, deploying EC2 images very similar to how you would maybe do a Docker image where the Docker upstream gets updated, you then do a new build, then you push that out. And now getting that same kind of capability directly from Terraform inside the HCP, which I think is a pretty great option. And glad to see that their rollout of HCP Packer is right on schedule as they promised this early release around this time in their first blog post.
Yeah, Packer was the first tool that we were so excited about from HashiCorp. It's so cool to see it getting a major upgrade like this and being able to tie it into Terraform. There's a ton of use cases here. I think that we've been using Spackle, some sort of Lambda Spackle, one way or another to fix. So this would be fun.
Yeah, I don't use a lot of these tools at this level. It occurs to me a couple of weeks ago, you guys reported on a story about AWS's new sort of integrated, gosh, I'm losing it right now. They had like an integrated API that they released that allowed you to do consistent resource level stuff and not have to learn the individual languages of all the different services as you were launching them and creating them and deleting them and moving them around.
Yeah, it's the new AWS Cloud Control Provider.
Thank you.
They just launched.
You wouldn't guess that I worked at AWS for a year last year, but and that was, you know, that seemed, you know, to a layman like me, seemed like a very similar kind of a move where these companies seem to be trying to simplify the way that you can do the orchestration that's like so critical to being able to automate everything that you do in cloud and have that kind of consistency.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, that's our next story is about the cloud control provider. So perfect timing, nice segue. You're natural with this. HashiCorp wrote a blog post about their recent partnership with AWS to build Terraform modules for AWS, of course. And then the Hashi team is delivering their new solution as open source. And they are working with AWS and internal AWS roadmaps to ensure that they directly benefit the community. HashiCorp and AWS intend to provide users with the most up-to-date API path to quickly deploy AWS resources while keeping the modules lightweight and composable. And they do highlight their recent AWS Cloud Control Provider as a great example of this collaboration. As part of the collaboration, they're expanding that to now offer a set of modules in the Terraform registry built on AWS CC, or the AWS Cloud Control Provider. They're calling the AWS-IA modules, all available to you now in the Terraform registry, which gives you a very unified, standardized way of deploying Terraform modules directly from HashiCorp. And again, you know, it's great to see AWS and Hashi really partnering hard to make this much easier for developers and end users alike to take advantage of Terraform and infrastructure as code. So I'm super happy to see these.
Nice. Yeah, there's always that line. There's always, you know, if you can build a module that is very effective for users across the board, regardless of what they're doing, then at some point it just becomes a resource. And so I think it's pretty tough to build complex modules that everybody's going to use stock as is and not want to fork and end up making their own. Like, we've done a ton of this with our FogSource, where we've got some modules that we start tons of projects off of. But it's pretty tough to keep those completely extensible to meet all requirements without ending up abstracting every single variable, making every single thing available, and basically just replicating resources in the provider.
Yeah, we always talk in the FinOps courses, we always talk about, you know, automating, finding those places where you've got opportunity to save money, where it's a repeatable, sort of well-defined, well-known process, and just automating that. Do you do a lot of that? I mean, this seems like a tool custom built for that sort of thing. Is that the kind of thing that you would automate?
Yeah, I just think it's usually unique customer to customer, situation to situation. It's pretty tough to do it, to build those generically so that all companies can use them.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
And once you've made them so generic that all companies could use them, they pretty much look a lot like the Terraform resources that you started with.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see the Terraform community in general, because it's, you know, there's definitely the Google side of it, there's the Azure side of it, and the AWS. I'd say right now, the integrations are the most tight between GCP and HashiCorp and Terraform in general. But, you know, AWS kind of seeing the light and saying this is a great way to go is going to enable a lot of new use cases. And then, you know, even things like cost estimation and cost management inside of Terraform, you know, you get that with Terraform Enterprise, but there are even open source projects that'll give you cost estimations right inside the Terraform plan. So if you know, like the Anton Babenko has a Terraform-cost-estimation in GitHub, where you just plug that right into your Terraform code, you get an estimated cost for that infrastructure even before you deploy it, which is really great. And those are the things that I hope to continue to see developing in the Terraform space as well.
Yeah.
Especially in the open source space, but as well as in the enterprise products.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a feature. Those types of tight integrations are going to make cloud so much easier than other infrastructure options.
Mm-hmm. And so much more consistent. I mean, that's the thing, is it's got to be consistent so you're not constantly chasing anomalies and edge cases.
I mean, I like to deploy all my infrastructure, you know, with the GUI. No possible way it can be consistent.
I like to do it with the command line, and usually by the 30th or 40th try, I've gotten it right.
Yeah.
And there's definitely not 39 or 39 other things laying out there.
That's how I used to feel about CloudFormation. It was always, you know, trial and error. And of course, with the 5 to 10 minute roll forward of CloudFormation, is always brutal. So I'm glad Terraform exists. It's so much better.
Oh, for sure.
All right, let's move on to AWS stories this week. So first up, this week we have a theme going, and that is security at the edge. It's a big topic apparently in the world of cloud. And so AWS recently released a security at the edge core principles white paper. And this will help your business and technology leaders ensure that the security of their environment and the security of the traditional cloud network extends to the workloads running on the edge. This provides security executives the foundations for implementing a defense in depth strategy for security at the edge by addressing three key areas, including AWS services at the edge, how these services and others can be used to implement best practices outlined in the design principles of the AWS Well-Architected Framework security pillar, and additional AWS Edge services, which customers can use to help secure the edge environments or expand operations into new, previously unsupported environments, which is, you know, pretty nice to have guidance. I always like guidance, but, you know, these things are always a bit of a, you know, squint at it. And does it meet your environment? Does it meet the requirements or not? So glad to see it, but definitely, you know, your experience may vary depending on how you're implementing Edge and your security protocols.
Yeah, I did security for a couple of very unhappy years, and this was, I was hoping this would be much more of a, like a more specific, you use this to do this in this way, but it's mostly a list of AWS services you should be using if you're operating at the edge. So it is a nice way to see like all the things that are a part of the security environment within AWS and what you should be doing as an executive. It's a good thing to be able to see. It's always nice to be able to see a list of things that should be in your environment and know that you can have the defense in depth to do that. But,
yeah, the service offering lists drive me nuts. I think a lot of what Amazon did with Well-Architected Framework is super valuable. I love using the Well-Architected Framework just as a starting point to learn about new customers, to help them understand where they stand in the cloud. But it is hilarious how you get into that point where sometimes someone walks the line between helpful information and laundry list sales pitch of things that you should buy.
Yeah, I do not envy security people in this current climate that we're in. Like the proliferation of cloud computing, edge computing has really, you know, had to get a lot of creative minds working together to try and secure data outside of your four walls of sanctity. You know, like you have to get out of there and figure out how to still secure your data. And so it's good to see big companies starting to chime in and address that, because I think it's just going to continue to keep growing. So
yeah, it's a huge area. And once you've moved beyond, I think what I don't hear anymore as often is that like deep concern that the cloud is not secure, right? That used to be 5 years ago. That was just was my data going to be safe in the cloud and that kind of thing. I don't hear that as much anymore, but you're right. When you do move beyond the walls of the enclave, it's really tricky to say like, well, what do I do out here at the edge? And everybody's pushing, you know, we see all these stories and these offerings from the vendors about edge stuff and edge everything, and pushing closer and closer to the devices the users are using. So it's got to be a confusing area. I'm interested that this is called a core principles white paper, because I haven't seen that before. But
it was new to me as well.
this may be in response to a lot of the stuff that Google's been pushing out recently, and even the stuff that Cloudflare was pushing about, you know, their edge offerings as well.
Yeah, the edge is definitely where the battle is happening between these cloud providers right now. You know, you have people like Cloudflare trying to innovate at the edge. You've got, IoT stuff going at the edge pretty heavily, and you've got all these things happening. And, you know, it's also breaking down the barriers of cloud security in general, which is why zero trust is becoming such a big deal across all of the cloud providers as well. Because once you go to the edge, now where does your perimeter exist? And the reality is there's no perimeter at that point. So now it's all about security and authentication and identification of users and needs.
Yeah, just assume all networks are public. It makes things so much more secure.
Mm-hmm. And then you also got to think like compliance, right? In a lot of categories as well, not just security when it comes to edge stuff. And you get these questions a lot, you know, like, well, where is the data being stored? What country, what location, who has access to it? When can they use it? When can't they use it? And so I think, you know, aside from just core principles of securing that information, I would like to see some more information. I mean, it's probably out there, right? And I just haven't really dived too much into it myself, but I would love to see more about, well, how do you evaluate, you know, edge computing in your environment that might be regulated a little bit more stricter than, say, some other industries? So, or how can you solve the problems that edge computing brings, right? Because there's a really, really good solution for a lot of companies. How can you take advantage of that solution with compliance being a barrier for you? I think that would be an interesting topic.
Yeah. Well, I think in general, we're at very early days of edge computing in general. And I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago. You know, there's really not a well-known software framework that makes it easy to do edge computing or to break up these things. Like we have pretty good patterns for microservices and breaking a monolithic into microservice. But how do you break a microservice then into an edge versus, you know, data center centric versus, you know, browser based application? And how do you do that easily? That doesn't exist as far as I know at this moment in the market. And so it requires engineers to do a lot of heavy lifting right now, and they have to have a need that drives them to that place. I don't think we're at the point yet where we've got a common framework that makes it easy enough then that you start worrying about all the other factors of it too. But you're right. We should be thinking about that now before it gets too late and we're trying to now retrofit something like DLP onto the edge in a terrible way sometime in the future. AWS Glue crawlers are now supporting S3 event notifications. AWS Glue, of course, includes crawlers, which is a capability that makes discovering data sets simpler by scanning data in Amazon S3 and relational databases, extracting their schema, and automatically populating the AWS Glue data catalog, which keeps the metadata current, supposedly. I've had mixed results with this, just to be fair. Like, even with Amazon known formats, it doesn't always detect it properly, and it doesn't always keep it up to date. In theory, it works. I've seen some edge cases. But when configuring the capability, you do need to choose from a full scan or an incremental scan and handle objects newly added to the folder. You could increase the polling and reduce the time, but it's not always ideal and it's expensive. And so today, they're announcing integration of Amazon S3 event notifications as a source for AWS Glue crawlers to incrementally update AWS Glue data catalog tables. I would also think EventBridge could have done this, but, you know, hey, I prefer the simpler model of S3 event notifications. This new model reduces the cost and time a crawler needs to update the large frequently changing tables.
Yeah, this falls into the category of one of those things I assumed already existed.
There are always so many of those. So many things I think exist that don't.
The S3 event notifications are so great. It makes things so easy to
to pinpoint the work you're going to do and not do too much work. And so that's, I hope that Glue get, you know, I saw Glue a couple times recently in some architecture diagrams as a potential solution. And I've always been a little hesitant because of my experiences with previous iterations of this product. But it is one that, geez, if you can nail this product, it's going to be something everybody wants to use.
Yeah. ETL is a hard problem to solve. And
yeah.
Yeah, those who are really into ETL, you know, struggle with Glue because it's a little bit limited. But you know, if it enables most use cases, it's a great solution. But it's when you get to those weird, complicated edge cases where it kind of falls down right now. But it's getting better. I think it has opportunities, but it does feel more clunky than I think it really needs to be.
I have nothing to add to this except that Glue Crawlers is an exceptionally cool name, especially near Halloween show.
Yes, yeah, that is great.
Oh, maybe we should change our title.
It does sound really
weird. Where was that in the show title?
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something that we can discuss, but what is like one of the primary use cases for AWS Glue Crawlers? Because I'm kind of in with Rob there. I don't really have much to add to that. I'm kind of thinking of more like with what Peter said. It sounds like, you know, what kind of functionality you get from like a SIEM tool. Right, where you're able to, you know, kind of crawl through data and get event notifications based off of what's in a JSON file or in a database or whatever. So that's kind of what I get from it. But maybe you guys.
Well, imagine like you have a workflow where you've got some system that's receiving data files, validating them, dropping them in an S3 bucket, and then each time they hit the S3 bucket. You want an ETL tool to pick that up, extract the data, transform it into a way that it'll fit into your analytics system or your data warehouse, and then just populate that data, update or add that data. And you want that process to be happening not in a schedule, but on demand. So now, you know, that Glue run could kick off the second a new file ends up in your sort of ingest S3 bucket.
Yeah, you know, Glue has a lot of other capabilities too, but that's the most common one. And where I use this one quite often is ALB access logs. You know, basically people coming into the load balancer, it writes an S3 bucket object. You know, every time that happens with their IP address, what thing they were calling, and I want to go then parse that with Athena. Before, you'd have to write this very archaic schema design JSON document that would basically define what the objects are in this basically a CSV file. And then that would basically build the schema out of the Athena, would basically go out and crawl all the data in S3 for you based on that schema. But if new fields got added or things got changed, you'd have to go update that JSON file manually. The Glue data crawler actually can look at that data and actually determine that the schema has changed or how the schema is modified and updated automatically for you. So that's really the Glue data crawler. That's one use case. And then there's Glue itself, which is ETL. So if you have, you know, an Oracle database that you want to take data and you want to transpose it onto a Kafka queue, Glue can also do that for you, for example, or change it to a data warehouse format and actually push it into S3 for a data lake. It has a ton of capabilities. It really just depends on what you want to do with it. And it's one of those tools that's a bit of a Swiss Army knife where it can do 1,000 things, maybe not any of them really, really well, but good enough.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
you're welcome. I love learning new things all the time.
There's so much to learn in the cloud and keeping on top of it is difficult.
Especially with AWS, and they keep adding new certifications and competencies all the time. And it's like, which one do you get? which one do you go for?
My recommendation is always the architect one because it gives you the broadest overview, but then go specialized after that. But it is still even hard.
Practitioner.
FinOps practitioner is good too. And not complaining about that one. Well, speaking of competencies, there is a new competency for consulting partners like Foghorn, which is the networking competency, which to me feels like a little bit of a gimme, just to be fair. That I don't know how you can do anything on AWS without understanding at least basic VPC networking. But apparently these partners have proven to AWS that they have a deep domain expertise in developing a consistent network and security policy, as well as solutions that offer a new way of routing traffic through private backbones and cloud cores. The AWS networking competency consulting partners can help customers provide secure ingresses and convenient on-ramps into clouds to mitigate latency, improve availability, enhance application experience, and provide visibility and control in all things cloud networking.
Yeah, so I think there might be some engineers over at Facebook who might need to
Yeah. Oh boy.
Discover not deleting all your BGP routes. I think this is funny as well. It seemed like the early networking advice that you would always get from the cloud providers was, you know, you don't need to use any of those analogs to your physical network layer. You don't need to use those virtual routers. You don't need to use any of those virtual things. So then to figure, just let the fabric do it for you. And now I guess this is the way to use the fabric. So I can't complain about my networking cost anymore after.
I mean, I'm still going to complain about NAT gateways, and I'm still going to complain about inner VPC costs for data transfer because they're too high. But it does help you maybe figure out why those things are high if you're not quite sure.
At least now the consulting partners will be able to figure that out for you, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like some partners like Foghorn, even they've had VPC in a box and things that are standardized for a long time. So I assume this is one you guys are going to go for at some level.
You know, yeah, these things come out so often, and there's like 90% of them we basically meet all the requirements for, but oftentimes the documentation and the process to get through getting the competency is just not worth the effort. So at some point we may, but a lot of these are just, it's just a challenge to keep up with them, and the value you get out of it, you know, customers don't ask that often for them. We went and got some of the important ones, you know, the DevOps and security competencies, I think were huge. We couldn't ignore those. But yeah, I mean, all of the very specific ones, it's pretty tough to keep up. Even if you qualify, it's like, you know, am I going to go through that much time and effort? I think it's good that they do it.
Yeah. I mean, it helps people find people who know what they're doing in the marketplace, which is really what it helps you differentiate yourself there between other partners. But, I don't know if this is the one that I needed. I think FinOps is the ones I want. DevOps are ones that I want. Security are ones that I want. This one, it just feels like kind of 101 that you got to have this. But maybe there's more to it that we'll learn about at AWS reInvent. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008, they are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
All right. Well, next up is AWS Data Exchange for Amazon Redshift. Amazon is now making it even easier for you to find, subscribe to, and use third-party data with the introduction of the AWS Data Exchange for Redshift. As a subscriber, you can directly use data from providers without any further processing and no need for an ETL process. So you don't need to use Glue. The data is always up to date, and you don't have to do any processing, and is available to you directly from your Redshift query. And as a provider of data, you now have a new way to license your data and make money, which is always a win. Multiple data providers are already working with Amazon, including data sets like the COVID-9 vaccinations in Canada, the U.S. car consumer payment data, for what I don't know what that is, from Factius, as well as many others as well. So I assume we'll see many more announcements heading into reInvent of companies getting onto the data exchange and making that available to you. And all I can see when I see this announcement is this is competitive with Snowflake, because this is one thing Snowflake provides to many, many customers, is the ability to take your data, share it through a common marketplace, and make it available to other customers using Snowflake to run reports against. So this makes sense to me in the constant era of Amazon wants to be good frenemies with Snowflake and provide better alternatives in their opinion, but also still support their partner.
I'm going to deploy my own in the data exchange. It's going to be what I had for lunch. See how many people buy it.
How much are you going to charge for it? Is it going to be an outrageous monthly fee, or are you going to go for a cost per access, or what's your licensing model on this?
All good questions. Yeah, maybe we'll start free to get people like really addicted to the information, realize they can't live without it, and then jack it up.
Nice.
I hear the freemium model is pretty popular in those cases. They just pay what you think it's worth.
Yeah,
so maybe,
they get lunch for free, but they got to pay for dinner.
Yeah. Hmm.
No, yeah, maybe.
I like it.
Is it the ultra premium?
Yeah, so like,
yeah, the ultra premium.
So if you want to pay a dollar, it's a dollar. If you think it's worth more than that, feel free.
All right.
That is awesome. That is awesome.
Have you used this thing? I'm curious about this. Like, are you actually buying this data set then from somewhere?
Yeah, you're buying access to the data set itself. So the vendor,
like a gift version of Marketplace.
Yeah, it is part of Marketplace, basically, part of the data exchange. But before, there wasn't really good ways to monetize it, you know, through the Marketplace. You could sell it as like one-time thing, but like to make it updated all the time and to do what they're talking about this article, that wasn't really there. So you'd have to go get the new dump from the vendor, go apply it into your system with, you know, a glue or some other tool, and then you could use the data. But now you don't have to do any of that work. It's all done for you. It's just available to you as a join, really, from your Redshift query.
Yeah, that is great. I think the changes they've done to Marketplace have been really, they've done a lot of changes to Marketplace, just being able to do more different models of paying for licenses and different models of paying for access and even buying like services and things through there. So this is great.
Yeah, it's been interesting. We've actually seen Microsoft, you know, is only charging 3% for Marketplace, and now GCP just copied them last week at Google Shift Next. You know, that they're only going to charge 3%. So it now leaves Amazon as the last vendor charging 20% outside of Apple, you know, in the cloud space. So it'd be interesting to see if Amazon follows suit this year at reInvent, or just as its own announcement saying that they're also going to lower their Marketplace cut, which then does that lower the innovation that's happening in Marketplace or not long term? I don't know. I still think it's a very profitable business for them, very lucrative. So I see them potentially lowering the fees, but yet still continuing to invest in different ways.
Well, it's also an enabler for selling all of their other products. You're going to buy Redshift because you have access to this data, et cetera.
Yep. It's the on-ramp to all the things that are expensive in AWS.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to GCP, which, you know, we're still a little bit in the hangover from Google Cloud Next last week. You know, lots of good recap articles for things we talked about last week and a couple of new things as well. So we'll talk about the new things. We'll save the recaps for you guys to find on the internet and go through, but listen to last week's episode if you're curious what they announced. The first one is, you know, Google telling you that data is an amazingly valuable asset, for those of you who didn't know. Full of PII and other things that are super important and attractive to hackers, and protecting this data is super important, but oftentimes the job is hard because you don't know what PII lives in what data store. And vendors have come out with solutions like Cloud DLP, Amazon Macie, for example, and former sponsor and hopefully future sponsor, OpenRaven. Google has offered a few years now an excellent Cloud DLP solution, and I would argue probably one of the best in the market from a hyperscaler. And now Google's making it automatic. With Cloud DLP automatic, with the automatic discovery, automatic inspection, automatic classification, and automatic data profiling now available to you in preview for BigQuery, you can enable Cloud DLP across your entire organization to gain visibility and to date your data at risk. With rich insights for each table and column, you can focus on the outcome, manage data risk, and ultimately help safely accelerate your business. Several benefits of automatic DLP, including continuous monitoring, the low overhead and cost, data residency compliance, as well as Google-driven, powered by their industry-leading Cloud DLP. So there you go. As long as this doesn't come with a nasty bill, I think this is really great. We'll see. I didn't find a lot of details on pricing, but you know, overall, the DLP was not too expensive beforehand. I imagine this automatic DLP in BigQuery may be something they just throw in for free. It's part of your BigQuery processing fees. But until the pricing is announced, once they go GA, we won't really know.
Anytime you have a service that you would otherwise have to stick in line, I think that those are services that should always be included in the cloud service to begin with. Anytime I have to stick an inline appliance in between a service and a user, that feature needs to be included in the service. This is one of them.
Yeah. I used to spend just a ton of money when I worked at the government on DLP stuff. And it never worked.
It never works.
I like that this is part of their what they're calling the invisible security vision, because that's, to your point, Peter, that's exactly the way that this ought to work. It ought to be just baked in.
Yeah.
I remember having to do research on, and not necessarily GCP data, but other data. And it's nice to see Google doing this, but you always had to you probably couldn't find a DLP solution per se. And so you just kind of settle for DLR, right? Data loss reporting. Like, can I report? Yeah. Can I report
exactly
if somebody downloaded, you know, 3 terabytes of data overnight? Can I get that notification, please? Like, just that, please. Can I get that? and that's usually what was the fallback. It was just to get the DLR going. So it's nice to see that they're starting to invest in that and allow it to automatically be, you know, within your environment. So,
yeah. Having seen the demos of this, and there's definitely a lot of great talks from Google Cloud Next that are on YouTube available to you watch, but, their DLP technology in general is super impressive. From the ability for them to dynamically identify it inside of a database to then, for reporting, but also, real time inline of a serverless function or a container, they can actually do DLP tokenization. They can do all kinds of really cool stuff with this technology, which is really great. And much more powerful than the regex on your desktop version of DLP that many of the vendors have sold for a long time. This is an area that I love to see innovation from Azure and AWS as well. But right now, Google's leading in this. If you need DLP, I've even talked about, I could almost send my data from AWS to Azure or to Google just to do the DLP feature and then send the data back. It's that powerful versus paying some of the vendors like Symantec and others who charge a lot of money for their DLP solutions. It's just that cost effective compared to the third parties you can buy.
I haven't heard Symantec for a long time.
Yeah. they're still one of the leaders in that DLP space. There's also others as well, but many, many companies have tried to win that battle with regex and failed.
I wonder if you start to see any correlation between companies that have previously invested heavily in machine learning, right? AI type stuff. If you start to see any correlation to their quality and offering in DLP, right? Symantec, Google, that kind of stuff. I wonder if that has any kind of underlying reasoning as to why DLP with Google is so good, if they're applying any machine learning principles to it.
I mean, I'm sure they are. Yeah. They have to be using ML and AI at this point. I think Google has some very distinct advantages in this particular space because of they've always been very data-centric. Think about Google products in general. They're all very heavily data-centric. And so I think, by the way they built GCP as being this very common platform, very common storage infrastructure, very common instance-based compute, they're able to actually apply these things in this invisible security method. It allows them to be much more powerful, much more flexible than, someone like Amazon even, who Amazon has a very firm belief in, services should not interact with other services unless there's a very clearly defined API and you configure it. And when you provision an EBS volume versus an S3 object, those are different systems. They might have some underpinnings that are similar to them, but they're not always completely unique. And so this is one of those advantages that Google really has being the third player into hyperscaling. They were able to make, different choices than Azure made and different choices than AWS made. And they have that advantage. Coupled with their really strong AI and ML, they can do these type of things, which is really why I think they offer it versus anybody else.
And networking.
Oh yeah, their networking is fantastic.
Yeah.
You guys have talked about this before. It's a difference in I think perspective on how to build these sorts of things, right? The global network, the global database, the global data store, the data stream. It's a fundamentally different way of looking at it. This is also the thing that causes Google trouble selling to groups like the government, though, because you then end up with requirements that say, how do I ensure that this email never goes anywhere but in the continental United States? And the answer to that is no, it's designed to do that. Mm-hmm. So it is a philosophy difference that I think has a huge number of benefits and some drawbacks as well, just like every other design.
Yeah.
And these are things that you need to be aware of in your designs of, highly availability applications, because the global nature of Google has different failure models than the regionalized model of AWS. And those are things you need to be aware of and how you design your application. So, all right. Google is also announcing Spark on Google Cloud, which they've had it forever in Dataproc. But this is what they claim to be the industry's first auto-scaling serverless Spark solution. Integrate with the best of Google Cloud and open source tools. Power ETL, data science, and data analytics use cases are all handled at scale. Customers have been able to run large-scale critical Spark workloads for enterprise customers for 6+ years with Dataproc. However, this With this, they can further eliminate the commitment to enabling customers by eliminating time spent managing Spark clusters, which is a pain, I can tell you. Enabling data users of all levels, including supporting BigQuery, Vertex AI, or Dataplex, and retaining the flexibility of consumption by either deploying it via serverless, which is really great, or on top of GKE or on compute instance clusters. This simplifies greatly your Spark workloads. And you know, since Spark is typically very job-orientated, this is a perfect use case for things like spot instances or serverless, where you don't have long-running jobs, but you actually have federated jobs out across thousands of workers. There's a quote here from Cyril Jain, Director of Engineering and Infrastructure and Data at Snap Inc. "We see serverless Spark playing a central role in our data strategy. Serverless Spark will provide an efficient, seamless solution for teams that aren't familiar with big data technology or don't need to bother with idiosyncrasies of Spark to solve their own processing needs. We're excited about the serverless aspect of the offering, as well as the seamless integration with BigQuery, Vertex AI, Dataplex, and other data services." So customers need to be happy. That's always good. I think if you're in the Spark space, this is something to check out for sure in your next spike.
Yes, yeah, Snap is just the gift that keeps on giving as far as references for GCP, huh?
Yes, they do quote Snap quite a bit. And there's a couple other key marquee customers I noticed. They are go-to customers on these things.
They use all the things. And if you thought your Splunk expert was really expensive, try to find a Spark expert. Oof.
Or a Hadoop expert in general.
So what you're saying is I need to go become an expert in Spark.
Yeah. I mean there's definitely some career paths that can save you a lot of, can make you a lot of money. Security, data scientist.
Where would you find
HBase, Hadoop?
Where would you find
it? Underwater welder.
Underwater welder.
There you go. Yeah.
Magician.
I think this is one of the key areas that where serverless actually makes a lot of sense. Like a little managed serverless model gets rid of a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah. A lot of heavy lifting. And then last week, we announced briefly that Google had updated their architecture framework. And this week, they detailed a little bit more about those updates. The updated architecture framework for Google Cloud has been updated with its set of best practices to design and build workloads on GCP that are secure, reliable, scalable, and also cost-effective and performance-optimized. They break their architecture framework into six pillars. The first is system design considerations. This covers foundational building blocks such as compute, storage, and database. Operational excellence, covering all things SRE to help you build and optimize your operational capabilities. Of course, security, privacy, and compliance, which would, if it was not here, would be a major faux pas, which covers all your security and compliance considerations that will enhance your security posture. Reliability, which covers topics that improve the resilience of your workloads. And then cost optimization, covering techniques and best practices to lower your cloud operational costs. And performance optimization, which covers tools and techniques to improve your workload efficiency. So this is a pretty comprehensive set of architectural guidelines and definitely will help you make sure you build a highly reliable application on top of the Google Cloud.
They look awfully familiar.
They do. They somewhat look like AWS's in so many ways.
You know, it was, I'm sure, somewhat intentional. It's nice to see that Google's not following the model of everyone else calls them tags, we'll call them labels. And picking different words and different things for different things, because this makes a lot of sense. I'll say that I've got some experience with their cost optimization bits, because they've been on a tear, really releasing a lot of really good information. For full disclosure, Google is a sponsoring member of the FinOps Foundation where I work, so take that for what it's worth. But the information that they're putting out in these in this framework and this cloud adoption framework is really nice. It's really useful stuff. It's very specific to the products. It really covers like how to use the products effectively for these different things. So I've been really impressed with the stuff they've done in the cost optimization area, and I'm interested to see all the rest of it as well.
Yeah, you mentioned labels versus tags, and sure, okay, I'll let you have that, but spot instances versus preemptible instances, I'm gonna tell you that's a terrible comparison. Spot is so much better.
I mean, folders versus labels. we want to talk about that? I'm just kidding.
I learned a new word for that right today. And actually, there was an article I was reading that was calling, because we always struggle with this at the foundation. We try to be as cloud agnostic and product agnostic as we possibly can. And so we always, you can't talk about a tagging strategy. You have to talk about a metadata strategy, because you have to incorporate tags and labels and other metadata that might be associated with resources. And you can't talk about an account strategy, because you might have to deal with accounts or resource groups in Azure
or projects
or projects. And in GCP. So I heard someone call those organizers, like a closet organizer for your for your cloud, right? They're all the different accounts and things, those kind of structures or hierarchical organizers that you can use to group your services and resources. There you go.
Organizers.
That'd be great if then they all just change their products to match your naming convention and we can just get over it.
I would love that.
You should write a book, Rob. Just write a book.
Yes.
You should get ahead of the game and just write a book about it. And then when people start adopting it, you'd be like, hey, I was there first.
it's a challenge. I give everybody at the cloud providers a hard time about this stuff, but it's really like for each company, there are incentives and disincentives to try to match language and to try to, you know, create differentiation in the marketplace. So I can see why the different cloud providers choose to make the choices that they do, but it is a bit confusing. It does create a bit of confusion among customers and when talking about the general offerings that are offered by all three of them.
You know what we need? We need an IEEE cloud naming standard.
There you go.
How great would that be?
That'd be awesome.
I will completely support you as chair of that.
It's like vendors, it's like they take it and say, how can we be the same but different? Like we have to compete. Yeah. We have to compete with AWS, we have to compete with Azure. So we have to offer services and solutions that compete and that are in line. But how can we be different so that way it doesn't seem just like we're copying or we're doing the exact same that they're doing?
In some cases, there's a lot of value in that differentiation, right? But in some cases, there is not. I mean, to be fair to GCP, there are things in GCP called tags. They're network tags. They're not metadata tags you apply to resources. So they are using that word in a different sense, and that may have predated the adoption of resource labels. So
it's interesting because back, this reminds me of a story. Back when I used to live in Washington, I would attend the Amazon user group, which was actually held at Amazon's headquarters. And one of the nights we were there, they had a breakout room topic about should AWS's API become the standard for all cloud? And, and this is back in the day of Eucalyptus and some of the other OpenStack things.
I remember this.
And, this is a big topic in the community at the time. And I remember being in the breakout session and, the Amazon people were arguing like, well, if this is the standard, it would actually slow down innovation. It would actually cause problems because going to a centralized board to get new APIs just slow everybody down. And this isn't the time the cloud isn't mature enough at that time. And I'd argue even 10 years later, it's still not mature enough to do this. So, as much as we would like a standard, I think I see their argument. I also see the argument for a standard, but I also think, the direction these three cloud providers are going, why they're oftentimes at each other, they're also innovating in interesting ways. Like, talked about the DLP project earlier. And I think if we were to stifle them, we would be unhappy with the long-term result.
I agree with that sentiment.
And we would blame them.
Of course.
For being unhappy. Yeah.
The bad news is there's all this innovation. The good news is there's all this innovation. Plus, none of us would have jobs if everything was already sorted out and named the same.
Right. And if costs FinOps was easy, we wouldn't have a FinOps Foundation, right? if it was easy. All right, well, let's move on to Azure for this week. First up is the Azure Synapse product. Now simplifies your analytics workloads by providing data preparation, data warehousing, and big data analytics in a single secure workspace. And now with pre-purchase plans, you can save up to 28% on your Azure Synapse workload, unless you're in China, which then you're out of luck. This differs from reserved capacity pricing in that it allows you to pre-purchase SCUs or Synapse commit units that can be used at any time across your workload. This includes data integration using code-free data flows, big data, and ML with Apache Spark, data lake exploration using serverless SQL, and data warehousing with their industry-leading SQL engine. And all I know is that adding another pricing model has to be for a customer, like potentially the government, who wants to buy everything in advance. That's the only reason why this makes sense to me, a former Jedi artifact, perhaps.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still, the discount is still service specific, but it's nice to have that flexibility across use cases. I mean, any of these abstractions end up being a really funny thing to have to measure. When you're looking certainly at the cost side of things, you're making a commitment to use these things over a period of time, and you're investing money up front to buy them. So it's a really specific use case for any kind of a FinOps or cloud financial management team to look at these service by service. It would be nice if they if the discounts would apply more generally, but I guess that's still a ways off.
So you're saying this is the difference between reserved instances and savings plans? And that's how I should think about it?
It's a little bit. I mean, it's more, I mean, these are just different use cases essentially for Synapse, it looks like. So they're applying more generally than having to pick the specific type of resource that you would want that to apply to. So in that sense, they are, but it's still very service specific. It'd be nice just to get like a data savings plan, right? Like everybody's always been asking for.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, next up is the Enclave Device Blueprint for Confidential Computing at the Edge, which is an Azure collaboration with Arm Technologies and Scalus BV. They're announcing the immediate availability of the Enclave Device Blueprint with a goal to make confidential computing a mainstream computing paradigm at the edge. And if you're using IoT, this is pretty great to look at and a good use case for secure enclaves. I won't cover all of this because it'll put you all to sleep. And we don't have a ton of people who are interested in edge computing at this level. But anything we can do to continue to secure edge and get good use cases for enclaves, which I think are still a pretty early paradigm for a lot of shops, I think is a great use case. And so if you're interested in this space, don't check out the article. It's in the show notes. I can't bore you all to tears or sleep, if you will, going through everything in this article.
Secure to the edge, baby.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of ARM technology. So. I wouldn't fall asleep.
We'll just call you Jonathan for the rest of the night.
Call me Jonathan.
Well, we're talking about ARM processors. It's a whole different thing than talking about, security at the edge and an enclave on a CPU die. But speaking of ARM, if you want to talk about ARM real quick, those new MacBook Pros look pretty nice this week.
What's the price? They're super expensive, aren't they?
The 14 starts at $19.99 and the 16 inch starts, I think, at $24.99. But the computing processing power is crazy on them. So.
But get an HDMI port.
You do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the MagSafe adapter is back. Oh, yeah.
I want to get one too.
And the touch bar is dead.
And the old keyboard's back. So like, man.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
They made
a lot of good. They listened to the community, listened to their customers. I know this is on the agenda, but since we're on the topic, it's interesting to see them, Apple, listen to some feedback. Since 2016. Only
5 years of hearing people hate the keyboard, hate the touch bar. Well, hate it the took dongle a city that we lived in. But, 5 years, I'm glad they listened eventually, I guess.
5 years, a class action lawsuit, and they are still fixing keyboards to this day, you would think. But, who's counting? Who's keeping tabs here?
Yeah. I definitely got on the pre-order bandwagon on that because I have an Intel MacBook that heats up my lap pretty much anytime I use it to do anything serious computing-wise. But, the ARM processors are just amazing. For listeners of the Cloud Pod, you know that I have no love for Microsoft Active Directory, which is why I'm excited to tell you about the leading cloud directory platform, JumpCloud. JumpCloud makes it easy to solve today's IT challenges by unifying device and user management through a single pane of glass, enabling you to securely manage your users and devices and perform common tasks like onboarding and offboarding remote workers. With JumpCloud, you no longer need to implement an on-premise Active Directory infrastructure or additional tooling to scope a user's access, and you can ensure that the user is coming from trusted devices and networks. Enabling JumpCloud's zero-trust solutions improves the security and compliance of your network, ensuring users have access only to the services they need when they need them. To start your organization's move to a modern, secure hybrid work model, try JumpCloud for free today at cloud.jumpcloud.com/thecloudpod. That's cloud.jumpcloud.com/thecloudpod. All right. Well, Azure HD Insights is pleased to announce that you can now restrict public ingress traffic in all regions. This enables a few additional use cases, apparently, including the ability to reverse resource provider to cluster communication such that it's outbound from the cluster to the resource provider. Support for bringing your own private link-enabled resources, think storage, SQL, compute, for your HD Insight cluster to access the resources over private networking only, and no public IP address are resource provisioned. By using Scalability, you can now skip the inbound network security group service tag rules for HD Insight management IP addresses. And I just had to say that the only reason this article is here is just make fun of this completely because, your Insight product that you have here, you did a press release, not just like a normal Azure press release, but you actually wrote a blog post about how excited you are to actually restrict public access to a thing. It's just, I don't understand. Sometimes Azure just doesn't make any sense to me.
Sometimes you just need something to talk about.
I guess, but they have so much more they could talk about in the Azure space that they just don't talk about.
Well, Justin, maybe you should consider getting the Azure networking competency for consultants.
Yeah.
Maybe I should, if they have such a thing. I wouldn't know because they don't blog about it ever. So it's always good to see these things. And, you know, with ingress controllers and now being able to attach things to your VPCs, these type of use cases get enabled more and more, especially private link enabled resources to pass services is a big deal. Every cloud provider likes to do a press release on these things. It just seems sort of silly at some level.
Some of these things you just kind of maybe float under the radar, you know, like to your point, like, oh, I can now restrict from public access. That's great. Where have you been?
Yeah. it's in the camp that Peter calls the, I thought I already did this.
Yeah. Oh, oh boy. I think I had that in diagrams like 18 months ago.
Wait a minute.
Azure's network has always had that public side, private side, split too. So this may have something to do with that I'm not getting, but, I think there's a lot of, that was always kind of a difficult thing for me to understand as we were designing Azure applications. But
yeah, I still struggle with the idea of a storage account versus a compute account in the Azure world. That one still kind of blows me away a little bit. Like I don't understand the distinction and why they chose to do that completely. I'm sure someone out there understands it better than I do, and they can write in and tell me through our feedback form, but I don't quite get it. So. All right. Well, next up is Azure Machine Learning. Always fun to talk about machine learning. A growing number of organizations are taking advantage of ML to increase efficiency, enhance customer experiences, and drive innovation. With the increased use of ML, customers might wish to consider a cost benefit and value analysis across infrastructure, ops, and processes, and of course, your cloud providers too. But Azure didn't say that. Azure ML is the enterprise-grade service to build and deploy models faster and accelerate the ML lifecycle with thousands of customers, including many Fortune 100 customers already realizing the impact and benefits provided by Azure ML. And some of the benefits identified by Forrester, who they paid, interviewed five customers, said that they have a 3-year projected ROI of 189 to 335% in their ML project. They improved their data science productivity by up to 25%. They gave you up to a 40% reduction in time to onboard new data scientists, resulting in reduced costs. They increased operational efficiency by streamlining model development, training, validation, deployment, and monitoring. And they improve time to value of ML initiatives and model accuracy, resulting in increased revenue and cost savings, and of course, cost savings from retiring legacy technology that they were potentially using in the past, which is all hilarious to me, considering they're such a huge Databricks partner, which is their other option for ML, which is also supposed to make all these things possible to you as well. But apparently you don't need Databricks, just use Azure ML. So it's great.
I thought this was a little funny as well, but I will say the you could read this more broadly, and the specifics of this Forrester report are not going to apply. But more broadly, this is the case for moving to cloud generally, right? These were the savings and advantages that they saw of customers who were moving from on-premises ML tools and ML infrastructures to Azure ML in the cloud. And so, like, you could make this argument almost for any kind of application development, right? It's better, you get better, faster ramp up, you get more efficiency, you get all these different things. But in this case, you're saving the time of your ML guys who are probably, or people that are probably your most, you know, expensive resources in your company. This is not like saving a few hours of some .NET resource.
It's a
person.
A lot of .NET resources out there listening to our podcast. Go easy on them.
Yeah. If you're comparing that, you know, that person's hourly rate with your ML,
yeah,
ML infrastructure person's top hourly rate for the company, that's got to be a bigger concern.
Yeah, I think if I were to reinvest my IT career into something else, it would be ML AI for sure, because data scientists are making by far significantly more than most other people in technology. Although we all do quite well, so it's a first world problem for sure.
I'm super fascinated by it, but it's just way over my head. It's just like to try to wrap my head around the science behind all of that is just, it's remarkable what their brains can do. It's way over my head though, being transparent.
I'm just dying for NFL teams to leverage this in a much bigger way. and see if you could basically subvert the salary cap and win games.
Well, they kind of already do use a little bit of it. Have you seen those commercials for AWS and how they do like the sports tracker and how they use like machine learning and that kind of stuff to kind of determine
I want to feed it game tape and have you tell me things that I wouldn't have known.
It would change the betting world if you can run some kind of algorithm, some kind of machine learning to know exactly what play is going to be next and how the teams are going to play.
Yeah.
The tagline on that commercial though drives me crazy every time. Stat that. I'm like, no, no. Clearly written by an Amazon marketing person. Stat that.
And they got to keep it simple, obviously, to be in a commercial, but the examples they give to me are not ML.
No, they're not. But you know, I do appreciate it. But you know, it's funny to me because like MLB has been a big ML AI, you know, customer, you know, originally AWS. Now they're on GCP, I think. You know, NHL, I think, is on AWS. Like, you know, it's sort of becoming just like, you know, who gets the TV rights is like, you know, who gets the AI ML rights for each of these leagues? And so then they become the, you know, the commercial and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of a weird paradigm, but I think they all are going to just kind of rotate through the cloud providers over time. And then eventually they'll figure out a really cool model, like, you know, predicting plays and that kind of stuff, which would be interesting.
You heard it here first on CloudPod, predicting plays with machine learning.
If I get rich, it's because I figured it out and I've been betting in Vegas on NFL games.
Where'd Peter go? We have no idea.
Well, let's move on to Oracle. I'm sorry, there is no Oracle news.
Maybe next week.
I know you're all devastated. I know. It's tough to do. Well, that takes us to lightning round, Peter. Do you want to explain the rules to our good friends, Rob and Ben, as this is their first time on the lightning round?
Yes, the rules are there are no rules. I will read some interesting announcements that weren't quite exciting enough to talk about in the main show. And if you have a interesting or funny comment based on the title, or God forbid, if you actually read the article behind the title, jump in. And usually, because I can't keep track of everything everybody said, I end up giving a point to the winner, who is the person who said the one thing that I remembered by the end of it. So you're never out of it, even till the end. So we will start with public preview announcement. AKS is announcing support for Kubernetes 1.22.
All right. It came out in September. It's now October. So they're only a month late. They are not in the running for the slowest provider to update Kubernetes. Sorry, AWS, you're still in the lead.
Or if you're really stuck on 1.21, you can fire up the old flux capacitor and go back 64 days.
Yes! 1.21.
Nice.
And also in public preview, IPv6 for Kubernetes.
Just like that's IP. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I haven't even updated to IPv5 yet.
Yeah.
Nice. And just like IPv6 for everything else I use, I will not use IPv6 for Kubernetes. So it's just another feature that checks a box.
What happened to IPv5?
I don't know.
I never asked that question.
I didn't ask that question yet. I didn't even know it was a question I should ask till now. Thanks, Rob.
Same thing that happened to IPv3.
I just accepted that 6 came after 4 all these years.
Just be happy it wasn't IPv 4.1.
Yeah, really? All right. Now, generally available IP-based website protection for Azure static web apps.
So they gave us a firewall for a static web app? Thanks. Appreciate that.
Well, I think this is capturing all the static I get for hosting my web apps on Azure.
Yes. That's true.
That is a lot of static.
Like the Crayola version of conditional access.
Ooh.
was that too salty?
That's awesome. There's no there's never no too rules salty. Here, so there's no saltiness.
Yes. The only rule that you should follow is if you have any non-disparagement agreements with any of the vendors. That's why I keep my mouth quiet sometimes. But moving on. Let's go with Amazon VPC Flow Logs now supports Apache Parquet, Hive compatible prefixes, and hourly partitioned files.
Hives and Parrots put together, huh? It's going to be interesting repetitive thing. mine. It's all mine.
Yes.
I said, Parquet, I can't believe it's not logging. That's your older reference for
you? True. It's true.
Also in public preview, customize Azure static web apps authentication with a serverless function.
So hold on. If they're static web apps, weren't they already serverless? Or am I missing something?
Well, now they have a function though. They're static with a function.
They're staticless.
It's the ultra premium static web app that's dynamic.
Also known as a dynamic web app.
object oriented.
All right. Well, AWS Outposts adds a new CloudWatch dimension for capacity monitoring,
which includes an automatic alert to your sales rep every time you're low.
I would like to burst my outposts. Please send me more hardware.
I could just hear the CIO on the phone now. Like, I know, I'll go to cloud to get infinite scalability. What's that? I'm out of space. But, Outpost is in my data center?
But wait.
Dolores, can I on the phone for me?
All right. How about if we work on empowering cloud sustainability with the Microsoft Emissions Impact Dashboard?
This is your number one priority. You know, more power to you. It seems like most companies right now are just trying to hire workers versus worrying about the emissions of the workers. But yeah, just me.
I will say this is a top of mind item for a bunch of people.
It is, but I don't quite get why. And that's what I care about the environment. I want to solve global warming. I want to solve all those problems. Yeah, but you're already going to cloud to be cloud, to be more efficient and to do these things which are already cloud. Like, what are you trying to get out of this metric? Enlighten me.
I think it's to show what their investment is doing for them with the green energy. Because you look at like Apple, who went and made all of their iCloud infrastructure, right, and all their servers and databases and that kind of stuff all green energy, to be able to report back and show like this was what our investments were. But back to like the common theme, I thought this was already a thing. Like I thought businesses were already tracking this. Right, like
it's a big corporate social responsibility thing to be able to report on this. I think this is probably table stakes at this point for the cloud providers, because they not only have to say we are green, but also use us and you get these benefits as well. This is something that directly accrues to the company, and it also helps the company to make cases against owning their own database, their own data centers, and running their own facilities. I just find it interesting that there's someone out there with the title Global VP of Microsoft Emissions.
There's only one like him. Yes. Only one person.
Some days.
Yes. Sometimes I feel like I could be that person. All right. Amazon Network Load Balancer now supports TLS 1.3.
I look forward to the emissions report on how many handshakes I reduced with this one.
Ooh. Eh.
So you know the difference between NLBs running TLS 1.3 and a used car salesman?
What?
The AWS NLBs won't renegotiate after the handshake.
That's a winner. No, there's probably no chance of anyone else winning when someone actually pulled a real joke out with a punchline. That is awesome.
That's well done. Well done.
I have to give my friend Vass credit for that one. He wrote that for me. I was thinking it was finally that they're finally encrypting handshakes, which we could have used back at the beginning of 2020.
Yeah. All right, let's announce Amazon Workspace's API to create new updated images with the latest AWS drivers.
And they couldn't come up with a partnership with Microsoft to add this to Windows Update? Oh, shame.
This is going to save me hundreds of hours administering my massive fleet of Amazon Workspaces, said no one ever.
True. There's dozens of us, dozens.
Well, you all laugh until you try to use the image builder. And then you'll be like, oh, now I get it.
No, I totally do get this, because you like, to do this, you had to launch your workspace, update the thing, and then create the new image, and then destroy the workspace, and then go in back and do it again.
Yep.
Yeah, it was painful.
All right. And to wrap it up, the AWS pricing calculator now supports one more, not all, but one more of its services, Amazon CloudFront.
I mean, I finally can figure out my bill. I've been waiting for this feature since November 18th, 2008, when they released CloudFront, because I still don't know how much it cost me to run this thing.
And you can only estimate the cost with reverse Polish notation.
I'm really happy that they
have I don't get that.
I'm happy they have a calculator because I can't figure it out myself. I see their pricing model and I'm just like, what is this? What am I looking at? Times, multiply, carry the five? What's going on here?
Well, and the pricing calculator is so valuable and it's, for the most part, it works so well. And then you get in there and you're like, and I've got workspaces or app streams or this or that. And, you're, and not included. And not included. And not included. Back to Excel.
It's getting there. The simple, it was, that was a tough transition from the simple calculator, the old simple calculator to the new pricing calculator.
It's still a painful transition.
God, I loved the interface though.
Oh, it's nice.
Right? I mean, yeah. That old simple calculator was one that was like, man, that interface just reminds me of the good old days, is what it reminded me of. Like, there was no frills.
I do like the newer one.
Well, yeah, it's all pretty and fancy, but I mean, the old one was like gritty.
Yeah, it was like an HTML web page.
It was like the good old days.
It reminded me of it reminded me of the early Amazon web store. So when I looked at
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
And that wraps it up. The winner, not Justin.
No.
It's Rob. Excellent job.
Thank you. I was playing for the ASPCA.
Excellent.
Nice.
And since you're not in the list, we'll just go ahead and give the point to me.
There you go. Pound sounds good.
Yeah, two. There you go.
Very nice. All right. Well, things are coming up in the cloud. And, you know, for several weeks or months now, we've talked about the state of the FinOps update. And I have done a terrible job explaining what this is. And so now we have Rob here, actually, who's a person who asked me to add this to the list of things we talk about. And so he can actually tell you what it is and what it really means and why you should attend. So, Rob, I'm going to turn it over to you. And we're going to record this for future episodes as well.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you for including it, because it is a fun event. Every month, essentially every month or most months, the FinOps Foundation sponsors what we're calling a mini summit. And it's usually on the second Thursday of each month. We're getting towards the end of the year where things are getting a little wonky. So the next couple are going to be on October 21st, which if you're listening to this podcast was in the past. The next one after that will be on November 18th. And the mini summits are a 2-hour event. They start usually at 8:00 in the morning Pacific time. And that's a place where we make big announcements for that relate to the foundation. And we have our sponsors and our members presenting from the working groups that do the work. So in this one that's coming up in October, we're going to be presenting the final outcome of our adopting FinOps working group, which learned about how to get your executives and the others who get to decide what investments your company makes to get behind this FinOps idea, behind the FinOps practice. We're also hearing from the Reducing Waste Working Group, which has done a ton of work identifying specific use cases where people can go out and reduce waste and that sort of thing. I don't have an agenda for November's summit, but those are always available on the website that's on the link that you have in here.
Perfect. Was much better than I do.
And the State of FinOps, by the way, is the name of the, it was the topic of one of the things. State of FinOps is our annual survey of people in general and FinOps practitioners in particular. And that'll be happening during November and December. So that will surely be one of the things we talk about in November. But if you're interested in taking the State of FinOps survey, that's available on the FinOps.org website as well.
Cool.
Awesome. All right. Well, other things coming up in the cloud. On November 3rd through the 4th is the Google Government Education Summit. It is coming up for all those government people who want to do things with Google, which, you know, it's always good. Definitely learn about that. And then, of course, Microsoft Ignite is November 2nd through the 4th with all things Microsoft and Azure. And then reInvent is still coming up very quickly on November 29th through December 3rd. In Las Vegas, still in person, not canceled, going to be there. They just opened up reserved session seating, which they made the cardinal sin again this year of making that terrible. So I went in advance and I favorited all my sessions that I wanted to go to. And then you basically are supposed to be able to register for a seat in the session. And of course, when you go to where your favorites are, you can't register from that screen. So thanks for that, Amazon. I really appreciate it. Hopefully they fix that. Although I've been complaining about this for like 3 years. So it's not quite there. A couple other things, though. There is a grassroots effort being set up for Meetup as a Service. This is for the in-person attendees. This is an opportunity for you to go sign up and get paired with somebody to meet and have a coffee or a lunch and meet somebody and do a little bit of networking. And so if you're interested in Meetup as a Service, we have a link to that in our show notes. Go sign up, fill out the form, and where you'd like to meet somebody, and you can have a nice coffee and meet somebody and talk about the conference, just get to know them. I did this the last physical reInvent we did, which was back in 2019. And this was a super fun thing to do. I highly recommend it. And I met some fantastic people through this effort. And then another little tidbit here, in Las Vegas is, of course, home to Meow Wolf, which is apparently, it's an art show. I've been there before. It's pretty awesome. It has all kinds of really cool interactive arts. There's a fake grocery store inside there. You can throw axes, all kinds of things. But apparently, they're running that with Anthos. So little Google connectivity to this. Probably not going to advertise that at AWS, but Anthos definitely has a little bit of a presence at reInvent this year if you're going over to the Meow Wolf facility and checking out all their cool art installations. And I'm sure there'll be vendors reserving it for parties and all kinds of things because this is a really cool space. I'm sure you'll be able to get there for free if you keep your eye out on reInvent parties and all those different places as well. And then, Rob, you have one more thing you want to tell us about. Tell us about the Open Source Strategy Forum.
Oh, yeah. Open Source Strategy Forum is in New York City. That's an event sponsored by Linux Foundation, which we're a part of, and it is primarily for financial services companies using cloud and using open source software. That's November 9th and 10th in New York City in person. So, hooray. Awesome. I'll be there in person.
Cool. Well, those are the things that I know that are coming up in the cloud this week or the next few weeks. Anything you guys want to add that I didn't mention? All right. The crickets are very loud. I hear them quite clearly. Ben, would you like to talk to a little bit about Jump Cloud and what you're, what Jump Cloud's up to? I know I talk about how much I hate Active Directory in our ad, which everyone here at the Cloud Pod knows that I'm not a fan of Active Directory, and Jump Cloud is one of the many solutions you can use to fix that problem. I think the best solution. But maybe you want to share a little bit about what you're doing in the community forum. I know you guys have a Slack team. Maybe you want to share that with our listeners too, since you're here to pimp it.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, Jump Cloud, obviously as a product, we're making a lot of headway. Big news recently around our Series F funding. So that was huge. Really is going to help us push a lot of initiatives with our product, specifically around, desktop management, Mac MDM, iOS, mobile devices, that kind of stuff, to be able to manage your identities everywhere across the board. But in the community, my job as a technical champion, technical ambassador, is to pretty much be everywhere I can be with IT admins and IT professionals. So, our Slack lounge is a fantastic place to be. We'll be at IT Nation next month. I'm talking to some of our MSP partners, it's a great. Great place to be. The company is moving very, very fast. If you worked for a company who's moving this fast, you kind of know where we're at right now. It's chaos every single day. But my job is to create a community that is not about Jump Cloud. It's about IT professionals. And I think one of the communities, a lot of IT communities that are out there, they struggle with like career and networking, right? And those types of things, and outside of just the knowledge base, and those are the gaps that I'm hoping to try and solve for. So that's it.
Awesome. Excellent.
Thank you very much. Well, I appreciate both you, Ben and Rob, coming to the show and filling in for Jonathan and Ryan. You guys did a great job. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Rob also, when we tried TCP Lightning Round, was weekend update style. He was helping write some of the jokes, so those jokes came back, which was great, and he won as I knew he would in the lightning round. But thank you for when we tried weekend update lightning round, which was a tremendous failure on our part. We did try it; it worked ish. But we do thank you for that time as well. But thanks.
Yeah, no, it's all good. It's all good. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the show, obviously from the very beginning. So I'm glad that things are keeping going.
Yes,
indeed. Awesome.
We'll have another fantastic week in the cloud, guys. Bye.
Good night.
And that is the week in the cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Foghorn Consulting and Jump Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, and send feedback or ask questions at thecloudpod.net or tweet us with the hashtag #thecloudpod.